Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Psych Mike. Today, we have me, Aradi. We also have
Lulu.
And our special guest today is Nasalifia from Polar Practice. Yay.
Hey. Thanks for having me, guys. My name's Nasalifia, which is a group of letters that people have not normally heard before. So my name is Zambian, just like me. I was born in Zambia, lived there till I was about 11, then moved to the UK and then to New Zealand. And finally, the first place I chose to live was Melbourne. So I moved here as an adult and have been here for about 9 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, it's my journey.
So I was kind of stalking you recently. And I saw that you started your PhD. Congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a cry for help.
Have you heard of what PhD stands for?
Permanent head damage.
Oh, damn.
Do you have a different one? That's the one I know.
That's the only one I know. Because my mentor is also a PhD candidate at Uni Melbourne. And yeah, she said she's been losing a lot of hair.
Okay, that's new. I haven't heard about that side effect of doing the PhD, but I'll keep an eye out in the shower.
So tell us about the PhD. Let's go.
Yeah, so the PhD is a really interesting one because it's in randomly in IT, so and human computing.
Damn. Okay.
Yeah. So it is related to my psych background. So it's AI and mental health is the topic, and I'm going to be looking at how to leverage generative AI for the delivery of more culturally responsive practice. So really kind of a fun area, an area that I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, definitely. Like we've seen how Polar Practice has basically taken over the mental health world because of this the culturally responsive technique that you guys have, you know? Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, we wanted to discuss today was the cultural responsiveness in clinical practice. How do you guys specifically include that in your practice?
Yeah. So, well, it's a bit of a story. I'll tell you about how Polar Practice came to be because it kind of fits into why we do what we do.
Yeah.
So I, as a naive 20-something-year-old, moved to Melbourne and was working in the justice space, which was really interesting and exciting. I epically burnt out in the most explosive way. Doing that work, and I was looking for a therapist, and I wanted a therapist that could do a couple things. So I wanted the therapist that was good, you know, tick, that's useful. The other thing was I wanted someone who would understand or at least allow for space for me to talk about my identity, because that plays a role in my mental health, right? Like I, you know, beautiful, but I'm going to describe myself for the audience. I'm a dark-skinned black woman. I'm heavily tattooed. I have a lot of different intersects of my own identity. And I wanted to be able to talk about all those parts of me.
Yeah.
And that was surprisingly hard to find. So being the perfectionistic firstborn daughter, I was like, you know what? Be the change you want to see in the world. So I started Polar Psychology. And that went surprisingly well, to be honest. It was a bit of a shock. And had a wait list pretty quickly after starting it.
Wow.
Then posted on IG, because I'm a millennial, Tigis Kabidi, who is a trauma-focused therapist. She's a senior counselor. Reached out, and we started working together. After that, 2020 happened. Pandemic.
Yeah.
COVID, hyper-visibility of the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, deaths in custody. People were not doing well. And Tigis and I both, again, very epically burnt out and decided that we needed to work a little bit differently. So we started to incorporate more community work, more consulting so that we can have an impact on systemic change. And started reaching out to universities to have an impact on how practitioners are being educated. So that is kind of Polar Practice. Our ethos was kind of built on being good at our job, but also allowing people to talk about the different intersections of their identity in therapy.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, like I've been to therapy in Victoria before, and it's so incredibly difficult to find someone that takes in who you, like, we're not just cookie cutter people, right? Yeah. There's so much more to us.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad that you guys have taken that responsibility and made it your purpose.
Like, what a great move. And I think it's sometimes it's difficult for people to truly find someone to confide in. So what Polar Practice is doing is really core essence of that.
Yeah, because I guess I'm curious. One of the things that I talked about that we try and do is get into the university space to have more content that is reflective of the global majority, which is a really, I think, a useful term. And also to have more femme voices, because, you know, we think of the forefathers of psychology that is very gendered, very
Freud.
Specific. Yeah. how do you guys find studying psych as to people from the global majority?
I mean, look, I would say that, like, doing, I'm doing psych and I'm doing, like, other bio subjects and things like that. So it's, like, very science-y.
Yeah.
But I would say psych is right now one of the more inclusive subjects that I have. Because, like, with bio subjects, I guess, you know, you follow what's been researched in the past and things like that. But psychology is, like, an ever-evolving field.
Yes.
So we need to
keep up with the time.
That's so right.
With my experience, I found that, like, psychology is quite inclusive of all different backgrounds, especially just with my experience so far personally. Like, everyone I've encountered, they're not, because I'm doing it under Bachelor of Arts, but we've also have, like, people doing it from science, biomed, even, I think, I don't know, but I think there was, like, an architecture kid who was doing it as a breadth subject. Yeah. So I was like, wow, okay. That's something very different. So,
yeah. I think that's the great thing about psychology, because it's looking at the human experience, and that can be, that is broad and intersectional and includes all people.
Yeah.
Who, apart from the aliens, we include everyone, actually. So it should be, and it is a field that can be really, really inclusive and really safe for lots of people. I'm glad you guys have that experience. My experience, just as a side note, which was many moons ago now, wasn't so inclusive.
So is it like the actual study of it, or?
I think the content became quite Western.
Definitely. Oh, if we want to go into that side of things, yeah. I thought, like, actually studying it at UniMal. Oh. Yeah.
No.
Studies and stuff, they're so male-centric, usually European or American studies, right?
Yes.
They definitely don't take in...
Yeah, very Westernized. Like, I don't think there's a lot of... they take in cultural context, but
it's... We had one lecture about cultural stuff.
Yeah.
In this entire... course that we're doing right now. Yeah.
I think that's the bit I'm critical of, because I think psychology is a field that touches everyone at every stage of development. It doesn't make sense for it to be broadly from one perspective, which is
weird. Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic is often where, like, all the studies are drawn.
Definitely. Yeah, because we were doing a couple of podcasts about, like, psychologists we hate. So we did Freud in the past. It was last year. And then last week we released one about, like, Milgram.
Yeah.
What's this guy starting with A. I don't know.
There's a lot of very strange psychological theories out there. So there's a lot to hate. There's a lot to love. Psych has a lot of potential, but we don't date for potential.
You're so right for that. Yeah, look, we haven't gotten there yet, have we?
No, not yet.
It's a long, long way ahead, in the future.
It is, but I think it can be closer than we think, because I think one of the things that we talk about a lot at the practice is around documenting what we are doing, because there are people doing... People from the global majority, I think the comment that I made is that the future of psychology is femme, queer, and from the global majority.
Yeah.
And those folks, we've always been in this spaces. We've always done this research. I think we're just getting to the point where now we're documenting it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen.
Exactly.
We're just getting into the research part of it, hence why I'm doing the PhD, so that it's written down, so that it happened.
Exactly. Yeah, I get that.
Women represent.
For real. Women in STEM, bro.
Women in STEM.
Well, you're doing AI stuff, so.
Yeah, I'm fully a woman in STEM.
Yeah, but, like, what got you into, like, thinking about, like, the coding and the AI side of things?
Yeah, so I'm a nerd, just in case that wasn't clear in any of this conversation. So a couple years ago when ChatGPT dropped, I started having lots of conversations with people about tech. So large learning models, which is what ChatGPT is trained on, are trained on the content that we currently have in society. Mm. And often that content is Eurocentric, steeped in misogyny.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of controversy around how AI is actually trained and the content that it's trained on. And, you know, there's been all these Reddit posts galore about the racist content that these generative AIs can actually come out with.
Yep.
So I think I got scared about living in a Black Mirror episode where everything is AI generated and it's based on the frankly racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic content that we have in the world. So I was like, well, again, being the overachieving firstborn daughter, I was like, be the change you want to see. So that's how I kind of got into it.
Yeah.
So not necessarily from a coding perspective, more from the ethics of AI perspective.
Yeah, because we had a podcast that was recorded last week with a professor called Piers, and this is his entire area of study. Because like a lot of us third years right now, we're doing a statistical programming subject called the Research Methods of Human Inquiry, and we're kind of struggling. Well, just a little bit, right? So it's like,
tell me more about that.
I literally sent a message to my friend this morning. It's like, if you find me dead in a ditch somewhere, you will find my laptop and like R Studio open on my, because we use R.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, you'll find that open on my laptop. It's just like, you know,
I feel like if you have experience in programming all the sorts, then you're absolutely gonna love it, because on my first tutorial we had a lot of computing kids and they were like, oh yeah, this is easy, man. And then all the people who didn't have any exposure to our studios or coding and the likes were like, help, we're struggling.
Yeah, that's why we're like fascinated. I'm like, damn, girl.
Oh, well, let me just, full disclosure, I am not doing the technical part of my PhD. It's paired with someone with technical expertise, because if I had to code something, I'm not really sure how to use most of the applications.
You're so right for that.
I'm not the person, but I will learn how to talk. I'm learning more about how to actually talk about
talk tech.
Yeah.
Damn.
Well, like, I don't know much about cognitive dissonance. I just think that it's a aspect that's really fascinating of psychology. Mm. And I was wondering, from my perspective, so someone who's like been exposed to multiple cultures. So a little bit about me, I've grown up in China and then I moved to Australia, so I've been exposed to like both sides of culture, and sometimes there's like sort of like the dilemma, especially like between my parents' very conservative perspective and like I think people often view Western countries as more like open, just out there, you can talk about whatever you like, it's less traditional, so sometimes I sort of have like multiple identities and like sort of like deliberate like, oh, like what do I do in certain situations. So I was wondering if you like have ever like experienced like the like identity crisis, I guess.
Oh my gosh.
Free therapy session, guys.
Well, that is such a good conversation. That's such a good question. In terms of identity crisis, every week, like I schedule it every Friday.
Oh, nice.
So by Monday, I've kind of come to formed an identity to go back to work with. But in all seriousness, there's the phenomena called the 0.5 generation, which is people who've moved as children.
Oh.
So you're not necessarily first generation, you're kind of in between, which is what we are, because I'm the same. I moved to lots of places when I was young. I think there's this interesting thing, because you're kind of straddling two worlds. You're straddling the Western world in which you're being educated. It's where most of your colleagues, your peers are kind of placed. And then you have the Eastern, for you in that sense, kind of perspective at home, and you have to live between both. You kind of don't really fit squarely within one and you don't fit squarely within another. And the example that I think of for myself is I hadn't been home to Zambia since I was 11, and in my early 20s, which was 5 minutes ago, in my early 20s I went back for the first time, and it was so interesting because my parents are both Zambian. I'm very phenotypically Zambian.
Yeah.
I look very African. I don't look ethnically ambiguous in any sense. But people knew I wasn't from there. Like, oh. People treated me like I was a foreigner, and they talked about me and talked to me like I was a foreigner.
Yeah.
And it was this weird thing of, like, having spent 10 years being like, I'm Zambian, that's my identity, but after 10 years away, and going back and being told that you're not quite Zambian enough,
mm-hmm.
which is a really massive shift for me in trying to figure out who I was then. If I'm not Zambian and I'm not, I'll talk about the place, Welsh or Kiwi
yeah.
enough, then what am I? And I've found lots of, like, fun and excitement and being in that in-between space. Because I talk about myself, I'm like, I'm a chameleon in different spaces because I have had to learn how to move between both community groups. And that means that I can relate to people in different spaces. I also know how to kind of code switch in a particular
Ooh,
way.
Yeah.
Like, I can talk to the aunties.
Yeah.
You know, I know how to talk to the aunties and how to convey different conversations. But I also know how to talk in the corporate space.
Yeah.
And in a purely an all-white space, which is most of the spaces yeah. I was in as a clin psych, to
yeah.
be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's, once you get past the hurdle of figuring out where you sit, it's such a massive asset to be of these two worlds. And it's such a beautiful identity to hold.
Yeah, because, like, I'm from a really rural part of India. Mm. So it's like, whenever I go back, even though I can speak the language fluently, I can read and write it. Like, you know, I can communicate with people fluently, but they immediately pick up
yeah.
that you're, like, you're not from here. Mm. I don't know what it is. Like, okay, like, in village spaces, like, everyone knows everyone. And, you know, if an external person comes in, they pick it up. But I was asking someone about it, and they're like, it's the way that you hold yourself. It's like, yeah. you don't hold yourself like you're someone from here.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know, maybe that's how they figured it out. But the code switching thing is you're so real for that. Like, this is not the way that we'd speak to an auntie, right?
Absolutely. First and foremost, I'll be very respectful.
You're so...
I'm bringing here my... you know, there's just, like, you know, there's the fun things that we can do in terms of accents.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's also, there's so much, there's so much more to it, because it's also how you hold yourself. So we have, like, in my culture, you kind of, like, curtsy when you say greet adults. So you kind of, like, poise yourself in a particular position.
Okay.
Even where you sit in spaces, because there's so much, like, in terms of, like, hierarchy, who sits on the floor versus who sits
yeah,
on the chair.
Yeah.
And then the way your tone, the words you use, it's such a massive skill to be able to switch and put those hats on in different, as we
exactly.
move between spaces. So,
yeah.
Yeah. It's actually, I think the next time you're around the aunties, like, it's actually quite a beautiful thing to see how much you can make other people comfortable in the space.
Yeah, no, like, if I'm going back to, like, my rural town in India, it's like, they're females, then you're not confident, really. Like, you're not mm-hmm. allowed to act. Like, if you act confident, you're, I don't know if I can say this on recording. That's basically, so it's like, when I go there, I just go as I am right now. Like, this person with, like, broad shoulders, and then they just treat you differently just because you can talk for yourself and you can stand up for yeah. yourself.
Yeah.
That's unfortunately another cultural dilemma, but yes. yeah.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. As a recovering preacher's child.
Ooh, that is trauma straight to the...
Oh, yeah, it's... I think there's, like, culture is such an interesting thing when we talk about it, because I think of, like, culture in different aspects. There's, like, big C culture, which is, like, ethno-demographic culture, so ethnic culture. Then there's, like, small C, which is, like, family culture. And then there's subcultures.
Yeah.
And sometimes those overlap really nicely, and sometimes they really don't. So the example I always use is, I'm Zambian. Full and through, my ancestry, my lineage is Zambian. That's my big C culture. Small yeah. C family culture is Christian culture. Pentecostal Christian culture, very specifically.
Yeah,
that culture. And I'm part of a subculture of tattoo. Like, I'm a tattoo enthusiast.
Mm-hmm.
And those three cultures,
they do not align.
If you ask my mom, it's like, nope, they do not. But, like, for myself, I think the way I thought about it is, like, I am all three of those things at the same time,
yeah.
even if they don't overlap neatly in other people's eyes.
Yeah.
For me, there's consistency because I'm spiritual. So
yeah.
that keeps the Christian or maybe religious culture intact yeah. in some way. I have a relationship with God that is complicated.
Yeah.
I'm very Zambian. I'm very proud of my heritage. And my tattoos are mostly my vegetables and fruits that my grandparents would have grown.
Aww.
So there's like consistency, but it's about creating that consistency for self.
Yeah. Because I was going to say, like, you've basically created an identity for yourself within all three of these cultures. And if we go back to like the code switching thing, like depending on which environment you're in, a different part of that subculture or whatever comes out to play, you know?
Lean into different parts of it.
Exactly.
Work it for the room, you know?
Otherwise, you'd just be one, like, boring ass slate of a person. Exactly.
We're so much more interesting than we let ourselves be.
Right. Yeah.
Also want to ask, I read on your website that you're actually a textile artist and you're part of NET. So can you tell us a bit more about that? Because
Oh my gosh, you guys really do.
Yeah.
We stalked you. Wow. We stalked you on every available platform. These are the dangers of the internet.
Yeah.
Keep yourself private, guys.
Yeah. So I guess I've only recently started calling myself a textile artist because a friend of mine who is a textile artist told me I should claim it.
Nice.
Which I appreciate. I think that is in relation to my love of fashion, but not necessarily fashion in the industry sense, but the idea of getting dressed.
Mm.
So just going to share a little bit about myself. In the process of lots of migrations, there were times in my family's life where there was some financial insecurity. And if you've ever grown up poor or working class, you probably know the idea of having to mask poverty.
Yep.
And the way I did that was around how I dressed.
Yep.
So I would like look out all the trends
that
were happening in the world, and I'd try and recreate that through thrifting, which is now very cool.
Of course.
Was not so cool when I was doing it.
Yeah.
So I guess I fell in love with the idea of adorning self, like the way you can put on clothes as an armor to prepare yourself to engage in the world.
Damn.
And I have a really cool, I had a really funny experience with a friend of mine who was, when I was doing my undergrad in psych, and she would be so unprepared for exams, completely unprepared. She dropped out of psych and went into something that was more appropriate in the end.
Okay.
But she said something really funny to me because she came to exams dolled like head to toe, like face done, hair done, outfit on point. And I was like, what's going on? And I was like, why didn't you spend this time prepping? And she's like, well, at least if I'm going to fail, I'm going to fail looking good.
Damn.
She dressed to impress the exams.
For real.
Yeah.
Easy H1, guys.
But yeah, I think having conversations like that and talking to lots of women, especially women of color, the way we dress is really thoughtful and it's really often intentional because we're either trying to convey something, mask something, fit into a space or not fit into a space. There's so much meaning made out of how we dress. And that's the kind of part about textile. I also sew, but don't ask me to make you anything. So that is kind of the textile art part. And the being on the board for Nets Victoria came out of my love for the arts in general. The reason I moved to Melbourne is because I actually fell in love with the art space and then decided to find a job.
Nice.
So that I could go to shows and the theatre and gallery openings.
You're so right for that. I would become a security guard at one of the arenas here if that meant I could go to like free concerts. But
for real.
Yeah, for real. Like Taylor Swift, you guys know, are fighting for tickets? Yeah, imagine.
I'm working security. Yeah. I'm in here. Yeah.
You know who was supposed to work at Taylor Swift?
You?
Yeah.
She was like,
what?
What happened?
So one of my side jobs is as event assistant, and so I've worked on several concerts, like on the events management side. So yeah, pretty cool.
It's completely off track. But what concerts?
More.
Yeah, what concerts have you worked on?
So I've worked at Post Malone.
Stop!
What? And you're just finding out this now?
Yes.
Wow. Revelation on the podcast.
Lulu has like seven different lives that we don't know about.
The intersections of Lulu.
Yeah.
What other shows have you worked on? Post Malone.
So I've done like music festivals like Spilt Milk. It's gonna work Sold Out, which you just
What happened?
Well, like I'm going on a retreat, so I miss out on
okay.
it. But I really want to see Tina.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, everyone and their mama is going to Sold Out right now.
They really are.
Yeah.
They really are.
I'm not. I'm staying at home alone. It's just me and my statistical programming, you know. Who needs Hinge when you got statistical programming?
Oh my God, I'm dead.
What else should we talk about? Oh, psychology and the collective distress in a global society.
I really gave myself like real big...
Right? They're like huge topics, yeah. Deep topics.
The concept, I like this concept of collective distress because we're in a global kind of society where we have access to information about what's going on in the world at the touch of a button. And that means that we have access to the traumatic things that are happening in the world at a touch of a button.
Yeah.
And we are appropriately distressed by it.
Yeah.
I kind of thought about this term during the pandemic because there's a story that I tell. I was sitting in a session with a client in person in between lockdowns and they got a call or a text during the session and they were like, they looked at their text and told me that we are going into lockdown at 5 that day. And I sat there being like, okay, so I have to hold your distress about this. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about all the things that I need to schedule for my day. And also like how tired, like all the, it's like we're paralleling the same experience in that moment.
Yeah.
Which in therapy, usually you're not experiencing the same thing your client is experiencing.
Yeah.
But in moments where we're going through something that is a global event, we're actually sharing that collective distress. So it's an interesting space to think about. Since the pandemic, there's been many more movements that have happened. Like I talked about the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, deaths in custody. All these things are happening for all of us at the same time. We also need to be responding to the collective distress as well as the individual one-on-one distress in the room. So it's an interesting space to be in. And I don't have the solutions for what we will do with that. But I think collective healing is one of the avenues that we can navigate in going into those spaces.
Yeah. Like when I first read that dot point that we had on the notes, the psychology and collective distress in a global society, I immediately went to... like a self-diagnosing.
Oh, that's a good one.
Just because that's like all over social media right now. It's like, oh, every single symptom that I, every single thing I do is like, an ADHD symptom. Mm. Or like, do I have autism now? Yeah. Right? Or high-functioning anxiety.
Narcissist?
Yeah, am I dating a narcissist? Becoming high-functioning anxiety, high-functioning depression. Like, not to be that person, but I feel like it's taking away from people who are having a lot... you know, a lot deeper experiences of these things. I'm not trying to invalidate people here.
No.
But, like, you know, it's the same thing as, say, like, someone who's a hypochondriac. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, my head hurts, therefore I have cancer. Mm. That sort of thing.
Hot take.
Am I going to get cancelled?
No, I love it. I think it's a really important conversation that I don't think is happening in as... Well, maybe it's not happening. I'm not hearing it happen.
Yeah.
This idea of there's a phrase, the democratization of information.
Yeah.
Means that everyone has access to most information.
Which is good. Yeah.
And when it comes to mental health and awareness, it's great that people now have information and access to what this diagnosis is. But there is an over-identification with certain presentations that may not actually mean you have that mental health.
Exactly. There's so many different symptoms that overlap and
I think it emphasizes the importance of being in contact or having access to a professional who can support you in the diagnosis process. That's really complicated and really difficult, and for all the caveats that needs to be put around that in accessing mental health support.
But horrible in Victoria, I would say.
Yeah, lots of caveats. But I think it's really important that as valid as it is to identify with certain symptoms, if it's also valid to also get support to actually get diagnosed, if that's what you're wanting. Because I think you're right. We are primed. If as therapists, we are primed to misdiagnose people.
Mm-hmm.
We are definitely primed to misdiagnose ourselves based on what we identify with.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah, because this is an it's not hypothetical. This is actually very real. So I know of someone who basically they've used like Instagram diagnoses and TikTok diagnoses, and they've made a diagnosis for themselves. And they identify with so much that they've like resigned from talking to people normally and things like that because they're like, oh, I have this, therefore this is what I am. Yeah. But it's like, girly, you don't even have a diagnosis yet. Like, I don't want to be that person, but also it's like get actual help instead of relying on what social media psychologists are saying, because who knows if all of them are psychologists? Who knows if all of them have accreditations and things like that?
Oh, let's not get started on social media psychologists. We'll end up down the holistic therapist hole that we don't want to go down. But
yeah,
there's, you know, we study just to validate us as therapists. We study for a very long time.
Exactly.
And we are held under very strict ethics around diagnosis. So we take it seriously. And I love that people have information, but I also worry that people will misdiagnose themselves and not get the support that they actually need if they have a completely different mental health
presentation. Like, yeah.
Yeah. It's a risk.
Yeah.
Well, it was more touching on, it's not like deviating completely from the collective distress, but it's more like individual, like, distress cycles for people. Like, is there any, like, predictable patterns or that just, like, varies?
So what can be predictable is how you cycle through things.
Ooh.
So what one thing that I do in therapy, but is also something I can tell you guys to do because we're not gatekeeping here, is when you have, like, a breakdown, however often or infrequent that is, after the fact, after you recover, it's really useful to go back and figure out what were the triggers for that. What is your perfect storm? Like, if these things happen for me, then I'm going to be in a bad place. So it might be things like you identify that if there's, you know, during cycles of university, so during exam period, if during exam period I have a fight with my partner or fight with my family, I am probably going to be in a pretty bad place. And that looks like me sitting by myself, isolating from people. And then the outcome is I feel worse. And then I come out of it after the exams are done. And then, you know, reemerge out of Plato's cave to say hello to society. Have you seen those memes that are like, hello world?
Hello world.
Yeah, you can map out the patterns for yourself. I know for myself, during uni, I definitely had that cycle of not sleeping very well during exam period, which meant I didn't eat very well, which meant my self-care was pretty bad. And, you know, I would spend way less time with anyone else that would support me. I didn't do anything that was nice for myself. And I'd be pretty depressed during that period of time and then come out of it and then not think about it, not reflect on what happened, what caused it, which means that the next time you fall into it without, and it feels like, what's the word? Like you don't have any control of it. It feels like you're just like, it's an inevitable thing when it actually might not be. So now as a grown ass woman, I still have those patterns with work when work is really stressful, but I know myself better, so I know that I need to put some things in place, like be kind to myself. Like, I don't do laundry most of the time, but it's definitely worse when I'm busy with work. And as I'm going back into uni, I know I'm not gonna do laundry, which is a sign for me that things are not going well. So then when I start noticing the pile on the floor, I start to think, okay, these are early warning signs. What do I need to do? Do I need to pull back from something? So those patterns are really useful to know because, yeah, you can help yourself feel better in the long run.
The starting point of all of that is self-awareness.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I as psych students, generally, we have a little bit more self-awareness that generally, just because, like, we're studying about we're encouraged to think in a certain way. But what do you think could kickstart that self-awareness in general?
Interestingly, it's a question that I'm having with academics about including and training for therapists about being reflective and reflexivity in practice. So the best that we've come up with so far is ask, who are you? Why are you doing this? And why do you stay in this field? So who are you as a person? So in general, just your identity. Why are you doing what you're doing? What brought you into psych? Like, for most psychologists and for most people who study psych, we have very personal reasons why we come into it.
Yeah.
And then usually it's a very different reason why we stay in it.
Yeah.
So, like, self-awareness is about asking yourself some questions about why you, who you are, why you do what you do, and why you continue doing what you do.
Yeah.
That's my hot tip for
self-awareness. yeah,
write that down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you speak to a couple of people and then you're like,
it's not there.
You lack. Some people, not you. I like looked at you when I said that.
It felt personal. It felt really personal.
Oh no!
She looked at me. She looked at the guest directly in the eyes and said, "You,
you lack." So, no. There's so many people you talk to, and it's like, do you even hear yourself talking half the time?
Yeah. I think psych students, I would argue, that are a little too self-aware, bordering into self-deprecating.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So maybe we need to pull back and we need to give back to the rest of the society.
Especially because like another third year subject right now, it's called the psychopathology of everyday life. And then we go through like different disorders and, you know, it's so easy to self-diagnose there as well. It's like, do I have this?
There's a specific phenomena that is actually for psych students. Once you start learning psychopathology, you start seeing how all the psychopathology as being part of your identity.
Yeah,
it's called something. I can't remember what it is, but it's interesting.
We're all just mentally ill. No.
Oh, that too. Also, I mean, you choose a job where you hear about people's worst experiences. That is saying something.
You have to be a certain level of
a specific kind of person that does that.
Yeah. Self-diagnosis. Yeah. I mean, this is kind of like going back to like the Instagram, self-diagnosis thing that we were talking about. But here it's people that are gaining proper knowledge in the field that are diagnosing themselves instead of going off on a basis of social media. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because that's even doubled down with the social
media.
Yeah. Back in my day, we didn't even have calculators. No, I'm kidding. I'm not that old. But I think that's an interesting phenomenon that you guys are sitting with, because social media is such a big part of mental health information access.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably need to have some like warnings. I've heard some therapist podcasts that say at the start, they're always like, this is not a replacement for therapy, and I'm not your therapist.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to have a disclaimer. Yeah. This is not a way to diagnose yourself.
A lot of like food nutrition Instagram people, like especially over COVID, they used to like run rampant all over social media. But a lot of people have like took them down a couple notches, and it's kind of like, if you're not a nutritionist, say that.
Yes.
Like, you're not legally allowed to
provide medical
advice, especially like in a world like you're presenting to an audience that's so susceptible to eating disorders, things like it's that age, it's all the teenager, the messy, you know.
Yeah
So it's like, if we can do that for nutrition, why can't we do that for mental health things as well?
That's very true. I think you guys, just throwing out their podcast idea, look into the social media downfalls of psychologists.
Ooh, write it down. Thank you.
There have been aplenty of people who are qualified who then don't understand the ethics of being a therapist and being a major personality.
Because they'd rather become famous one way.
Yeah, so then there's a few. I'll send you a few names.
Oh, okay. we will out them later on the MUPA Instagram. Yeah.
This was fun. Thank you, guys.
No, thank you, man. Like, is your mic completely off now?
Mine?
Oh, now it's on. Yeah.
Sorry, I just wasn't making out with it that time.
Yeah. Anyways, this was Psych Mike with Arati,
Lulu,
and
Nasalifia.
We hope to see you sometime soon. We also have a networking night happening at the end of the semester. So be sure to check your emails, because we will be inviting Polar Practice.
We love to party.
Yeah, 100%. Oh, this one's a lot more casual. It's like, just kind of chill, bro. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. I better head off back to the other side of town.
West Side?
West Side!
Yeah.
Just going back to the Wild Wild West.
The Wild Wild West, yeah, no, 100%. No, West Side, Best Side, guys. Yeah, anyways, see ya.